It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A newly released survey by one of the country's largest teachers unions documents the struggles of adjunct faculty on college campuses, including low wages, lack of job security. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Randy Weingarten is president of the American Federation of Teachers, which commissioned the report. Randy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be with you. Happy Wisconsin morning today.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So looking at salaries here, first of all, more than 25% of adjuncts nationwide in your survey say they earn less than $26,500 a year. Here in Wisconsin, we know adjunct instructor with the universities of Wisconsin earn a minimum of $36,800 annually. Why do adjuncts earn so little money?
Because as much as we say college is important, we don't act like college is important. So what you've seen is, you know, investments into big, beautiful stadiums and sometimes into the infrastructure of universities, as opposed to the human infrastructure of universities. And what we've seen over the course of the last 30 years is an inverse relationship and a deprioritization. So, for example, 30 years ago, 80% of college students were taught by faculty members who either had tenure or long-term appointments, whose focus was both research and knowledge making, as well as instructing. And now 80%, 70 to 80% of college students, even though they pay a lot of money for college, are taught by adjunct instructors who are cobbling together, racing between campus and campus, and cobbling together a sustainable living, or frankly, an unsustainable living, by having these gig jobs that don't even provide healthcare. And so it is the undermining of knowledge in this country. It's the undermining of education in this country, even though college now costs a whole lot more than, you know, when I went to, you know, undergrad and law school, you know, in the 70s and the 80s.
So what is the purpose of adjunct faculty? What purpose do they serve on universities and college campuses?
They basically are the backbone of teaching on universities, in community colleges and in colleges and in universities. And what we're trying to do, you know, and you see it in terms of graduate workers as well, who, you know, who end up doing a lot of the TA work and a lot of the lab work. But what's happened is, if you look at the universities, you look at the UW universities, Plattsville, Oshkosh, Parkside, lots of different places, you see a tremendous amount of teaching being done by adjuncts. And yet at the same time, the legislature in Wisconsin is trying to create austerity, squeezing and making it harder and harder. But what happens is that it's bad for both the teachers and it's bad for the students. So if you're trying to cobble together, five different teaching gigs to make a sustainable living, then you don't have any time to do the other work that teachers do, particularly teachers, college teachers, having office hours, being able to just, you know, have a kid who, you know, needs some, you know, care and attention. You don't have the time to do any of that. And you also are not getting the healthcare that you need. So you're spending, you know, gobs and gobs of money in terms of healthcare. And you're also putting lots of, you know, in Wisconsin in particular, where transportation is hard. So how do you transport yourself if you don't have a car with, you know, to these five different jobs and five different campuses? So it's really, it's saying that the backbone of the teaching is done by people who are essentially having huge anxiety about just ensuring that they have a sustainable wage. That's why 22% in this report say that they have anxiety about food security. 45%, only 45% have access to employer-provided health insurance. And, you know, so you see all of the different things that just have a blaring, you know, amplified noise that says anxiety, anxiety, insecurity, insecurity. And that's hard for people to teach them.
Randy Weingarten with us, president of the American Federation of Teachers, as we talk about the growth of adjunct faculty at colleges and a report from the American Federation of Teachers. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Randy, your report finding 75% of adjuncts are guaranteed employment for one semester or term at a time. How does that inconsistent employment for adjunct instructors affect student learning?
Again, it's a matter of insecurity and in every which way. So if you are not, if you don't know whether you're going to have a job the next semester, you're constantly worried about that. Let me be clear. There's a difference between the issue of being effective as an instructor, whether it's higher ed or whether it's K-12, versus this level of insecurity because of either economics or because of capriciousness. So knowledge requires that the instruction of kids requires you to actually be knowledgeable yourself and to actually, frankly, take risk to ensure that kids really are learning. Our jobs are not to teach kids what to think, but how to think. And, you know, you really have to push in a higher ed environment. You have to really push to get the best out of young adults. And so if you have no idea if something that you say may turn up as something that an administrator hates and you don't have a job, then you're not going to have your A game all the time. And that's what I think people don't understand about this level of insecurity, food insecurity, insecurity about, you know, always being uncertain about, you know, what you can and can't say. We see that a lot in particular in K-12, but look at what has happened in Wisconsin over the last, you know, 10, 20, 10 years.
I do want to jump in here and just make sure we understand that this is in both public and private institutions. Did you find in the report differences between the experiences of adjunct faculty at public institutions versus private colleges?
Great question. what's happened is that we've found this consistently through private and public. But what has happened is that we are, you know, our universe is mostly public institutions and you know, places, even with places like the land-grant institutions that are supposed to be so far exceeding in their mission to teach all kids. We're seeing real, real pressures in the public institutions, particularly since you have, and Wisconsin is case in point, this constant austerity, squeezing, squeezing, squeezing.
Randy Weingarten is president of the American Federation of Teachers, discussing the union's new national survey that documents the employment experiences of college adjunct faculty across America and here in Wisconsin. Call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The American Federation of Teachers finds colleges and universities across the nation are increasingly relying on adjunct faculty as a less expensive alternative to tenure-track educators. We explore this national survey in the environment for adjunct faculty in Wisconsin and hear from you. Call in with a question. Add your views. 800-642-1234. We have Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. Let's take a call now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hello.
Good morning to you. I have thought for at least 30 years that all state-supported universities should get entirely out of the sports business. The fact that UW head coach for football is paid over $10 million a year is clearly showing that the university is not putting forth for the students its best efforts. I have been upset for years about this fact. Universities were formed to make people employable. When you come right down to it, they are employed to make people, I should say they were formed to make people employable. Whether those people will go on to be research scientists, teachers, attorneys, doctors, whatever, they're going to be employed people. Universities do not have to pay anybody $10 million for a football coach.
Nancy, we
should get out of all sports.
Nancy, we got to thank you. Randy, go ahead.
So, look, sports are, you know, part of the DNA of universities. So I'm not, you know, I think that I appreciate what Nancy said because of the deprioritization of, you know, liberal arts and of some of the other academic fields. But this is where it's really important to ask the question in America and, you know, in different states. If we believe that a college education is important, and if we believe in opportunity and equity, then we have to make sure that the academics are not deprioritized and are not defunded. And so, whereas I appreciate sports, you know, I'm a big football fan myself. It's a matter of ensuring that the academics, the core work that universities do to help young adults learn how to navigate career, life, civics, that those core foundation stones are there. And that means it's going to cost money as opposed to squeezing. That's really the point of this report, because these adjunct teachers and the kids who go to university are shortchanged because of the decisions that have been made, not just by colleges, but by America itself. That's why we're calling for, you know, more state and federal funding for college education.
Republican lawmakers are pressuring our state universities to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. And your survey estimates less than half of educators believe college administrators guarantee academic freedom. Are these concerns over academic freedom affecting classrooms?
Yes. I mean, look at right now what's going on in terms of college campuses on the issues of the Middle East. I think we have to find a way that academic freedom is a really important value. Again, it's teaching kids how to think, teaching young adults how to think, and how to actually navigate the world in ways that people can hear each other. And at the same time, thinking and discourse is not equivalent to incitement. And so part of learning, part of academic freedom, is to ensure that there are forums and ways that people can hear each other, to not say this one can't go on campus or this one can't go on, you know, can go on campus. It is a matter of really trying to ensure that that the ability to think and the ability to hear and to wrestle with ideas are sacrosanct at the same time as we fight anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and other kinds of hate. Now, that's one thing. The second is a campus that is more diverse and more reflective of who America is right now is a campus where we are going to help kids learn tolerance and understanding and the reveling in our diversity as opposed to the, you know, just being in, you know, their own corners of a sports field. And that's part of why diversity and equity and inclusion are so important. If we believe in opportunity in America, that means we have to create the ladders of opportunity. And that's why DEI is important.
Randy Weingarten with us, president of the American Federation of Teachers, unpacking their survey on the growth of adjunct faculty and impact on college campuses. You can join in 800-642-1234 with your question. Rich in Rhinelander is here. Rich, hi.
Hi, thanks. Not to get sidelined on sports, that's not what my comment is about, but the ancients definitely believed that sports were an integral part of education, but it was sports for all, not for an elite group. My comment is about my experience in education is watching what we called part-timers in the system in which I operated, Wisconsin's adult vocational technical education system. Adjunct faculty are essentially the migrant workers of our time. And I'm reminded of an Edward R. Murrow special way back in the early 60s called Harvest of Shame. I just want to say I consider it shameful that major universities, whether private or public, treat the people who do the essential work of learning as though they have to rush from place to place in order to even cobble together a full living. They have families. The most important thing we have is in our lives is time. Advertisers even remind us of that. And we're denying these people adequate time, both academically and personally.
And their personal. Rich, thank you. Randy, I want to push this forward. What would a fair formula for adjunct faculty look like?
So a sustaining wage in a community would be a fair formula, and healthcare benefits and some time to ensure that faculty had office hours for kids. I mean, Rich, I chuckled when Rich said that about the ancients because he's absolutely right. You know, a thought about what human development was and is that you are tending to the mind and the body and the spirit, which is why sports was so important for all. but, you know, you know, we should be having media literacy for all kids, you know, K through higher education. We should be making sure that kids are exposed to lots of ideas and have to be able to wrestle with it. So that's why things like not just instruction in a classroom in front of 500 people, but having the time so that kids know that they have office hours for professors. That's why when you're cobbling together five jobs at the same time as a professor, you're not doing what you need to do for a young adult. So we've done in different places around the country collective bargaining to try to raise adjunct salaries, to try to raise instructor salaries. There's been strikes around the country because of this as well. But ultimately, it needs to be supported because of the unaffordability of college. There needs to be more local, there needs to be more state and federal investment for all of this.
Randy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate you.
Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, representing more than 200,000 people who work in higher education. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The world's first treatment using the gene editing technology called CRISPR is approved by regulators in the United Kingdom. We examine how gene editing could change disease treatment and the role of Wisconsin researchers in it. You can call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Krishanu Saha is a biomedical engineering professor at UW-Madison's Wisconsin Institute for Discovery and a member of the National Institute of Health's Somatic Cell Genome Editing Consortium. Chris, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Good morning. So United Kingdom regulators approve the gene editing therapy CRISPR this month to treat sickle cell disease. How significant is this milestone in medicine?
Well, it's the first. I mean, I think the entire field is just elated to hear this news. I would say about 10 years ago when the first discoveries of CRISPR came out, it was an abstract idea that this could actually be used in a medicine and prescribed by doctors. And today, that's the case. In the UK, a doctor can prescribe Exa-cel, which is this stem cell treatment that has been modified using the tool called CRISPR that you just mentioned. And, you know, it's been a long time coming, and this kind of abstract idea is now reality.
Some reports use the word cure to describe the use of CRISPR to treat sickle cell disease in particular. Is cure an accurate description of the treatment?
Well, it's certainly a loaded term, right? I mean, I think all of the signs point that it could be a cure. And in my opinion, it's probably on the path to being a cure, but really time will tell, right? So the clinical trials are concluding such that it got approved in the UK, and it is expected to be approved in the US next month, given all of the data released so far. But, you know, the trials thus far have limited duration, you know, on the order of years. Thus far, out of the about 45 or so patients that have been treated in the trials, the response rate has been really high. And the kind of endpoint that they're looking at in the clinic is the reduction of severe pain crises. And some patients have reported, you know, almost complete elimination of those symptoms. And so that, in, you know, in their own words, some of them call it a cure, which I think is probably the most accurate way to think about this term. But of course, we want the cure to be durable, lasting for a lifetime, and we haven't tested this yet for people over a lifetime. Fortunately, the FDA has mandates a 15-year follow-up after approval. And the company that is making this drug, Vertex Pharmaceuticals, is planning to do that follow-up as a condition of the approval as well. So we'll see. I mean, I think everyone is hoping that it will be a cure. And so far, the preclinical data and the clinical data all seem to indicate that it is working as expected.
Gene editing therapy, as you say, you want it to be durable and lasting and really have an impact on a wide range of diseases. Could you step back and explain how gene editing therapy works, and maybe in the context of sickle cell disease, for instance?
Sure. I'll back up just a second to say that CRISPR is a tool that can specifically change letters in the genetic code. So you and me both have the human genome within our cells. We have a copy from each of our parents. And so we have two copies of 3 billion letters in our code. And what's remarkable is that CRISPR can go into this code and change just one letter. And just one letter can unfortunately cause disease. So in the case of sickle cell, which is one of these examples, a letter change on both your copies of the genome can lead to the sickle cell trait, causing this sickle shape of your red blood cells. And so the what that effectively does is that you need hemoglobin to transport, you know, the oxygen in your blood in these patients. And so what this therapy that just got approved does is that it changes this portion in your genome that controls the fetal form of hemoglobin. Normally is turned off in adults, and so there's a stretch in the genome that controls the expression of hemoglobin, essentially to turn it off in adults. But it gets turned on in utero during development, and so CRISPR is used to essentially modify that area of the genome and turn on that fetal version of hemoglobin. And that's turned on in therapeutic levels. You can measure that form of hemoglobin in the blood after treatment. Those seem to be durable after modifying those cells and putting them back into the patient.
We're talking about a breakthrough treatment for sickle cell disease. Chris Saha with us, professor of biomedical engineering at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions and comments about gene editing therapy and the future. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. CRISPR, using this, I think what you call a viral delivery system to edit genes, are there downsides to this method?
Yes, as you mentioned, to get the CRISPR tool into cells, many researchers and companies have used viruses in the past. This actual medicine is not using viruses to transfer CRISPR, mostly because you can take out the cells. These are cells of the blood system that you can take out and put back in. It is not a straightforward, easy procedure, but it can be done. And so you can do these manipulations in the lab that allows you to do CRISPR without viruses. But of course, there are tissues that are in the body that you can't just simply take out and put it back in. So for one of the examples in our lab is editing the retina in the eye. We can't take out an eye and just put it back in without complications or really good engraftment. So we need to actually deliver CRISPR into the eye, and there are ways to inject drugs into the eye safely through with the help of ophthalmologists, of course. And so there, the standard in the field is to use viruses. The drawbacks to using viruses is that our bodies can recognize them as foreign. And so after one-time treatment, most patients develop antibodies against the virus, such that if you wanted to redose and give more of the drug, it's not very effective. Your body can recognize it and create an immune response. So one of our strategies that we're developing is to avoid viruses altogether. We use some new chemical compounds that are in nanoparticles that can essentially mask the CRISPR machinery such that cells take it in. Hmm. And once inside the cell, the CRISPR can go in and edit the genome. And so those are really exciting approaches developed by my lab and our collaborators here that we're trying to move into the clinic here in Wisconsin within 5 years or so.
kind of masking medicine, if you will, by mixing it in with something else, it sounds like. Let's take a call now. Kimberly in Ripon has a question. Kimberly, go ahead.
Hi, I have a question. This CRISPR technology would affect my child. So she has a rare disease, and the gene editing has always fascinated me. It would be essentially a cure for her rare disease. I'm wondering how reproduction would look for these patients that would receive this gene therapy in the future. Are these edited genes passed down?
Kimberly, thank you so much for that question. Chris, go ahead.
Well, that's a great question, Kimberly. That's actually a concern for really any type of medicine we put into the body. There are forms of CRISPR, a few in development. There's two companies, Intellia and Verve, that are developing these mRNA versions of CRISPR that you would inject into the bloodstream and target the liver. And there, the FDA has asked them in their safety studies to monitor whether any of these edits get passed down into sperm and egg cells that could be used for reproduction, right? And the short answer thus far is that it's a no, because most of the and almost all of the drug is absorbed by the liver and kidneys and other places in the body. It's not really designed to edit heritable cells or these germ cells that could be passed down through generations. That actually is a very controversial application of this technology that many in the field think is a place that where we shouldn't go. But at least for these types of therapies, the one that was approved, the ones that are trying to target other areas of the body like the liver, the eye, the brain even, those are probably not going to affect the next generation.
So somatic gene editing affects the patient being treated, targeting their genetic mutation, probably or not passed on to future generation. But then germline editing is different. What is that?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So somatic comes under terms soma or body in Latin. So that's really localized to the actual body that gets the treatment. It should not be within the germ cells or cells that lead to heritability in the next generation. But you could edit those cells specifically through standard reproduction reproductive medicine methods like in vitro fertilization or in embryos, or you could hit them by accident when you edit the body. And so if that happens and you have a child using those cells, every cell in the child would carry that edit or modification. And so that type of work has been thought to be too risky and with unknown consequences over, you know, multiple generations. And so many guardrails, policies, regulations have been developed to try to prevent that type of application.
UW-Madison biomedical engineering professor Chris Saha, our guide to how disease treatments could evolve in the future using gene editing technology. Call in at any point, ask a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Regulators in the United Kingdom approved the use of gene editing therapy to treat a devastating hereditary blood disease, sickle cell disease. We learn how gene therapy could change the treatment course of other diseases and the contributions of Wisconsin scientists. You can call in at any point, ask a question, bring your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Chris Saha is a professor of biomedical engineering at UW-Madison's Wisconsin Institute for Discovery and part of the National Institute of Health's Somatic Cell Genome Editing Consortium. Let's turn to your program, CRISPR Vision Program at UW-Madison, researching treatments for two hereditary diseases that cause blindness, the Best disease and Leber congenital amaurosis. Why focus your research on these eye diseases?
Well, first of all, as you mentioned, there's a great need for them. And so we're hoping to impact patients here in Wisconsin. The promise of CRISPR is to have a one-shot cure. And in these cases, the genetic mutation is only a small stretch of letters, in some cases just a single base in 3 billion letters. And so we think we can develop precise editing strategies to fix those mutations. And we've taken advantage of a lot of work over the last 5 to 7 years by my collaborators here that see patients with these diseases and make human tissues that mimic this disease and animal models that mimic this disease. And so all of the testing that we've done thus far show a lot of promise that it can actually correct the defects in these cells. And so the task for us over the next 5 years is to formulate a medicine that could be used here in trials enrolling these patients. We think the eye is an accessible organ because we can inject through these routes of administration easily right next to the cell types that are affected in these diseases. So there's a number of technical reasons why we think the delivery challenges are manageable. And plus, the amount of material that you need to modify the retina is relatively small compared to a systemic disease like muscular dystrophy, where you need to fix, you know, arguably all the muscles in the body. The portion of the retina is really only a few millimeters, arguably, that you use for vision that lead to a lot of meaningful functional benefits.
I want to attach onto something you said, a small stretch of letters in 3 billion. And Elizabeth called from Verona with a question along those lines. How is it possible to identify which part of the genome is contributing to physical characteristics? How do people go about reading that code?
Well, we've invested a lot of taxpayer money to mapping the human genome, and this is a lot of work by geneticists that have and advances in genomics that could both map and read the genome. And so we're catalyzing and building upon that type of understanding such that not only can we read the genome, but now arguably we can write the genome into portions of the body. And so much of the standard diagnostic workup, and in the rare disease space, this can be a long process, actually. So there can be kind of a diagnostic odyssey that takes years. And there is a need to diagnose these diseases earlier, such that we can intervene earlier. Some of the excitement in the field is this drug that was approved a few years ago called Zolgensma that's used really shortly after birth. As soon as you can identify the inherited genetic disease. And we're hoping that we can treat and prevent disease as early as possible, as soon as we can diagnose and detect the genetic issues.
we're talking about breakthrough treatments using gene editing therapy. Chris Saha is a professor of biomedical engineering at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. And you can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chris, when you talk about the ultra-rare disease space and what is viable treatment, accessible treatment with gene therapy, what is the clinical path forward here in medicine for access to these types of treatments?
Yeah, that's one of the most important questions in the field. We think it requires quite a bit of collaboration between academics and industry. The ultra-rare type of scenario where it's maybe only one patient that has that particular genetic issue or a few patients or a few families, I think it's very hard to imagine a large pharma company, you know, investing $1 billion to develop a drug just for a few folks. So there's been a lot of creativity, I would argue, in terms of the types of partnerships and models to address those types of issues. There is a current interesting initiative from the FDA called Operation Warp Speed for Rare Disease that is engaging this CRISPR community to see whether we can have a platform type of approach such that if we're able to treat, let's say, one or two of these diseases, like Best disease in the eye, that will be really the tip of the iceberg for how we treat other diseases with other variants. Because in our mind, if we're able to demonstrate that we can get a treat a rare disease in for one type of variant, we think we can easily switch the CRISPR system to treat another gene variant quite quickly.
Along those lines, in our last minute together, where is your research headed next?
Well, certainly we want to move forward over the next 5 years in the retinal and eye space. We're also developing some exciting applications of CRISPR in the cancer therapy space. So we're taking out T cells and natural killer cells and modifying them such that they can detect cancer. And CRISPR is an amazing tool to be able to write in the type of functionality that we want to personalize cancer care with these engineered cell therapies. And there, we're also taking advantage of some industry support and the recent White House declaration that Wisconsin is the tech hub for personalized medicine. I think that will be a lot of wind in our sails to move those projects forward.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
It was great to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Chris Saha is a professor of biomedical engineering at UW-Madison's Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, leading the CRISPR Vision Program. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.